Hey, welcome once again to the Psychology Games Podcast, the world's most popular podcast about psychology and video games. I'm glad you made it. I was starting to worry about you. My name is Dr. Jamie Madigan, and I'm your host. My goal in life is to delve into the psychology literature and come back with things to help you understand why games are so often designed as they are, why games are so often marketed and sold as they are, and why we gamers behave as we do when we play. This is the episode about gamification and game-based assessments. It's the third in a mini-series I'm doing that takes us beyond what's normally covered on this podcast, but without leaving that whole psychology of video games thing too far out of sight. You may have noticed that a lot of things are being gamified lately. That is, game elements like points, levels, leaderboards, and narrative hooks are being incorporated into things that are clearly not games. Things like shopper loyalty cards, voter registration tools, social media, classroom tools, just to name a few. I've touched on gamification as a topic on this podcast before with my guest Carl Kapp back in episode 17. That one's entitled Gaming Psychology and Learning. You can go and listen to that if you want to hear more about gamification in the classroom. But I think there's a lot more to learn about gamification, especially in the context of the workplace. Many companies are trying to apply it to make employees more motivated, productive, and, yeah, happier. But just slapping on some points, badges, and leaderboards usually doesn't cut it unless you also have other features that truly leverage what people love about games. So, how do you do that? Why does gamification work in some implementations and fail in others? And what exactly are the differences between games, gamified experiences, and gamification? And while we're on the topic of games in the workplace, did you know that some companies are now deciding whom to hire based on the people's performance in games? Are they going to be looking at your win rates in certain League of Legends champions or asking about your kill-to-death ratio in Call of Duty? No. God, at least I hope not. Can you imagine? The game-based assessments that these companies are developing are a bit simpler than the AAA games you and I probably play, but they still look like video games. And some companies are doing a better job than others because some are adhering to not only good game design, but also good assessment science and validation. But how do you do that, and why is it so challenging to get right? After all that trouble, are there actually advantages to using game-based assessments over just giving people a multiple-choice test? What do researchers studying the effectiveness of these game-based assessments find when they take a close, honest look? And use a little science. These are the kinds of questions that I will answer with the help of my guest expert on this episode of the podcast. Before we get to that, though, remember that you can go to psychologyofgames.com to get hundreds of articles in all the past episodes of the podcast. You can also find out how to subscribe to the podcast and get all the articles you want emailed directly to you. Leaving a review on iTunes or wherever you get this podcast helps me a great deal, as it helps people find the show. And if you really want to help out, you can go to patreon.com/POG, where you can give me just a dollar or two a month and get an ad-free version of all the podcasts, plus additional episodes of the podcast in the form of audio versions of my new articles. All right, everybody. Welcome to the interview portion of the podcast. My guest expert this week is Dr. Richard N. Landers. He's an associate professor at the University of Minnesota, where he holds the John P. Campbell Distinguished Professorship of Industrial Organizational Psychology. His research concerns the use of innovative technologies and assessments, employee selection, adult learning, research methods, and the things that he studied include, for our interests, game-based learning. Game-based assessments, often video games, gamification, virtual reality, and online social media, all things that we here at this podcast are interested in. His work has been published in the Journal of Applied Psychology, Industrial and Organizational Psychology Perspectives, Computers and Human Behavior, Simulations and Gaming, just to name a few. And he's been thinking, researching, and writing about how video games can serve as templates for testing people's skills, abilities, and aptitudes, and how that sort of differs from this concept of gamification that many of us have heard about. Dr. Landers, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
So can you kind of expand on that introduction a little bit and tell us what kinds of things you've been studying recently and what you're doing that might be related to psychology and video games?
Sure. Well, you know, I focus mostly on the the management side here. So understanding how we can use video games to understand or to predict behavior in the workplace, people working in these positions. in organizations. So when we look at video games, we look at it from a couple different perspectives. The one that we're focusing on most now is assessment. It's understanding how can we learn about people based on you know, how they perform in video games. And we're mostly focused on video games that are designed for that purpose. So there's actually a bit of research already on, can we kind of co-opt existing video games to measure characteristics of people? There's a bunch of research on Portal 2, for example, and what you can do with Portal 2 to understand kind of problem solving and that sort of thing. So we've been focusing instead on what happens when an organization, a consulting organization, actually goes out and tries to create a game explicitly for the purpose of understanding, you know, something about people. We've also looked on this gamification side, which is a little bit different. You know, it's more about taking kind of lessons out of games and then applying them in different contexts.
Right. So when we talk about assessments in these games, and we're really talking about measurements, things that people might think of as tests. So, you know, in assessments, especially in employment context, you might think of going in and taking a multiple choice test that measures your, you know, ability to read electrical schematics, for example, if you're applying for an electrician job. But in this context, it does include tests, but it also may include some other ways of assessing people's skills, like through having them interact with some sort of game. I want to talk a lot more detail about that, but let's kind of talk about one of the other topics you just brought up, which is gamification, since that is what tends to come to mind in my experience when most people think about sort of games, and they think about games like in the workplace or games outside of entertainment generally. Briefly, what is gamification? What gamification? How gamification? And how does it differ from what most of us consider, you know, games or video games in the traditional sense?
So that's a fun question. So, you know, originally I didn't personally, and I think a lot of people don't distinguish between them. They think about games and gamification as kind of this general concept of kind of gaminess or gamefulness is a word that we've used. But they differ in, well, let me tell you a brief story then. Where this became important for me and where I started to notice the term gamification as potentially being different from games was from an article that appeared in The Atlantic by Ian Bogost a number of years ago, titled "Gamification is Bullshit."
So, I am familiar.
Yes.
Yeah, I've read that one.
So it's a really fascinating kind of perspective. Ian is a professor at Georgia Tech, I think. And he was writing about kind of how games, the word games and the word gamification are used as kind of a sales tool rather than to represent what they kind of actually are, which is this sort of games are usually these kind of interactive narratives, and they deliver an experience to a person. Whereas gamification, the way that it was being described by organizations, was often sort of a shell game where you would try to pretend that you were doing something that was like games. It takes advantage of this word gamify, which, you know, when you say if I at the end of a word, you imply you're converting something into something else, right? When you classify, you're giving something a classification. When you deify, you're treating something as if it is a deity, as if it's a god. So when you gamify, it's this sort of promise that you're turning something into a game. And I read that, I thought, you know what, that's not really how people think about it, but that is, from my perspective, kind of what's happening. That when people talk about gamification, there's usually talking about some process that they think is boring, or people aren't engaged with it, or whatever it might be, and they think that, oh, if I turn this into a game, that will somehow inject fun into the situation.
Yeah, they're not doing something I want them to. What's it an easy fix for getting them to do it?
Yeah, and so the struggle, I think, is that people that want the power of games often don't really understand why games are successful in the first place, and it leaves a lot of room for people who are not quite so honest to kind of inject what they claim are games into these kind of work processes. So that's what ends up happening in these organizations, where someone will say, oh, we're going to gamify, and then they'll come in and throw some leaderboards and points and badges into a system and just assume, oh, great, now it's gamified and everybody will be happy.
That's the Holy Trinity: points, badges, and leaderboards.
Right. And you know, for me, that's such a small part of what games really are and what makes them successful. And you know, there's also a research literature that talks about why people play games, and it's not, you know, people don't just have a natural drive to get points. It's because points mean something. And if you don't engineer an experience for somebody where points are meaningful, then gamification is not going to work, assuming you're using points. So you know, it was that kind of exploration that led us to really want to understand exactly what gamification is. Like, how can you take something that's not a game and make it more gameful? How can you improve that experience in a reasonable way? But we wanted to do it in a more mature, maybe, or at least a more thoughtful way than just let's throw points into something and see what happens.
So you did do a study, Landers, Bauer, and Callen, that was just recently published, 2017, in Computers and Human Behavior, where you did actually look at like that done well, right? Where you had a successful implementation of gamification, or you looked at a successful implementation that involved leaderboards. Can you kind of walk us through that research and what you learned from it?
Sure. You know, the idea behind gamification, as we were just talking about, is really about understanding how to motivate people in a meaningful way. So it's not just assuming, oh, people like shiny things, so I'm going to add shiny things, but really thinking about, you know, what is it about a game experience that actually changes how people behave and how people act? Right. And so leaderboards in that study were our focus, because leaderboards have, you know, on one side, they have stood the test of time. There's leaderboards in games going back as far as we can tell. The idea of tracking how people are doing and explaining to people, you know, this is what we value and this is what you should be paying attention to. And we wanted to understand, well, is there some framework that explains why leaderboards have worked in the past? That there's some aspect of leaderboards that for most applications tends to make them effective or not. So we looked into you know, the research literature in IO psychology, and found this. We have this classic, really well replicated, really well understood theory called goal setting, which is really which is really fundamentally about understanding under what conditions do goals motivate people. And some of the really cool research out of goal setting is that, well, there's a lot of it, but one of the cool things that we noticed is that, you know, when people feel essentially, I guess you would quite call it agency, or, you know, they really believe in the goals that they have. It's something we, in the literature, goal commitment. Yeah.
Yeah.
So when people have a high degree of goal commitment, they tend to really believe, you know, in the goals that they're given for them. And that's, you can maximize goal commitment a lot of different ways, like by having people self-set their goals, or by having, you know, somebody that they really trust give them the goals, or, you know, some way to get them invested.
You know, just like a explanation of why I'm giving you this goal by somebody that they trust and believe. Yeah.
Yeah. Any level that lets you let somebody kind of engage. So we looked at leaderboards, and we said, you know what? A leaderboard is essentially an implicit goal, or even a series of goals. Like you're essentially saying, look what other people have done. Look how they've performed. Look how they've been successful in the past. It gives a lot of the same.
Screw those people. I can do better.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it still gives a lot of the same messages about leaderboards. I mean, we see it in games and competition more broadly. Like, you know, every time that there's a new major milestone in how fast a person can run a mile, then suddenly a huge number of people can run it just as fast. There's this sort of aspect of it where you, by seeing someone else has done this before, it gives you more confidence and more motivation to try to achieve it yourself and to win. So, so we saw all that, and there was a lot of parallels to goal setting. And we said, well, you know what? Maybe we can understand the effectiveness of leaderboard in terms of goal setting. So we created kind of a classic goal setting study in the literature on goal setting. This like one design that is associated with a huge number of pieces of research, which is you basically assign people to different types of goals. You give them what's called a do your best goal, which is what it sounds like, or you give them an easy or a difficult or an impossible goal, and you contrast between those to see what happens. And it's based on this finding in goal setting theory that when you give people goals that are just a little bit more difficult than they're really comfortable with. It's sort of this sweet spot of kind of motivating people, saying, "No, really, you can do it." It's that same sort of motivational thing with the mile runs, where you say, "You know what? If you self-set your goal, then you would probably set a goal that was easier, because that's what humans kind of naturally do. So I'm going to set a goal for you that's just a little beyond where you think you can be." And that encourages people to perform kind of at their maximum potential. When you give people impossible goals, it sometimes has a contrary effect, where people say, "You know, that's literally impossible. And I, you know, I don't see how I could possibly achieve that." And they kind of give up. So when we look at a leaderboard, it's kind of like that, except that you now have multiple goals. You see that people at the top of the leaderboard, the people who have performed the best, and you also see people that have not performed quite so well. So yeah. you get to self-select.
Somebody's
going to
be at the bottom. Yeah.
Yeah. So when you self-select your goal, that introduces all these other kind of dynamics, because now in the work context, you don't have to say, "Oh, I'm going to set your goal for you," and guess where that sweet spot is. You're essentially allowing the person to pick where that sweet spot is, to try to figure out for themselves what do they want to try to achieve. So that's what we did here, is that we presented that classic goal setting study with do your best, easy, difficult goals, and impossible goals. But we also put a leaderboard in, and the leaderboard had initials on it for people that had previously had taken the study.
You're giving me a little sneaky, huh?
Yeah, a little. And we matched those scores up to the same goals that were in the other conditions. So we took those easy, difficult, impossible goal values and just stuck them in the leaderboard. So the top score was the impossible goal.
So the only difference between the groups was whether or not they were assigned the goal or whether or not they saw it as an option based on looking at a leaderboard.
Yeah. So they were said either, you know, do your best on the following task. Here is a specific goal to reach that was either easy, difficult, or impossible, or there was just a leaderboard. And we actually didn't tell them what to do with a leaderboard. We just put a leaderboard there. Yeah. So there was no instruction, you know, try to win. We just gave them this leaderboard and said, do whatever you want. And the task itself was brainstorming. The idea was here, they were trying to think up as many ideas, I think it was for a knife, as possible. And the goal is to encourage people to be creative. So, you know, you can use a knife to open a tin can is kind of the easy part. But people came up with all sorts of crazy ideas. But the idea being, we wanted to see how many ideas did they come up with when they saw this leaderboard with an impossible, difficult, you know, easy goal on it, versus when we actually gave them those goals. And the answer was that they tend to perform at roughly the level of that difficult goal. So the mean, the number of ideas they came up with when they were in the leaderboard condition was almost identical to the number they came up in the difficult goal condition. So you end up with much better performance by using a leaderboard versus just saying, do your best, you know, you figure it out. The other piece that we looked at in that study was to see if goal commitment actually mattered the same way. So we asked them about their goal commitment, like how valuable and how committed were you to the goal you were given? Or in the leaderboard, we asked them how committed, how valuable did you see the leaderboard? How valuable was achieving a high score for you? And found the same mechanism across both contexts. So when you have a leaderboard, you know, people who feel committed to scoring high essentially do better, as you would expect. But all of that together then provides this support for this idea that, you know, goal setting theory could provide a really strong foundation for understanding why leaderboards work at all. That, yeah, you know, it's a lot of the same mechanisms, that you're giving people goals, you're prioritizing, you're saying this is valuable, you're saying this is something that you can achieve, it's something other people have achieved. You know, it's just a lot of the same sort of psychological mechanisms that you see in just vanilla goal setting.
So that sort of suggests that if you're using a leaderboard in a work context and you're trying to get people to improve their performance, you would want to maybe not show them the global leaderboards where the people at the top, you know, are able to perform that well because they have access to resources that you don't, or they have years of experience that you don't. And so that might look like an impossible task for that person. But if you sort of dice it so that, you know, they're looking at people who are similar to them and whose high performance is sort of within the realm of possibility and something that they might want to commit to, then it's going to be much more effective. And then sort of go the other direction with that, like don't show them a leaderboard that only shows like newbies on it, or you know, people who are whose performance is really low relative to yours, because low goals don't work either.
Right.
They don't, by definition, they don't require you to increase your effort and thus increase your performance.
Yeah. And, you know, it's something that game designers have realized, you know, I don't know how many like mobile pay to play kind of games that you play, but leaderboards very popular in those. And something that happened in the very beginning of those games was that there would be a global leaderboard. And so you would play through the game one time, you know, a simple little like 15-second experience and you die and you're like, oh, I got 10 points. That seems pretty good. And then a leaderboard pops up and it's like number one score, 37 million. And then you're just like, why am I even trying? There's no point in doing this. And so what started to happen is developers have pulled back on that. And so now you have like daily leaderboards or even local leaderboards, like of your state or your city. I mean, there's all sorts of ways to do it so that the goals that you see are reasonable. So it's something that people have picked up on, even though it's not really been formalized that I've seen in, you know, in any formal kind of like games literature that I'm aware of, but it's so well explored in goal setting. I mean, that's kind of part and parcel. If you give somebody a goal at work that is you say, I think you need to achieve sales next month of, you know, $500,000 and your average is 20, then you're saying I might as well quit. Like, why am I even here? And it's that same sort of dynamic.
Yeah, you'll either not accept the goal and just suffer the consequences, or maybe even go so far as to sabotage, you know, efforts by other people, or however you can sort of reduce that impact on you. So that's really interesting. I love it when, you know, theories from well understood and well researched theories from psychology are then sort of applied in a different context, like leaderboards, whether it's in gamification or whether it's in video games. But sort of as gamification is often done, though, what typically keeps it from being as successful as it could, and what sort of prevents gamification interventions from being, you know, quote unquote, good science?
You know, a lot of this is kind of market related, where right now it is so much easier to just layer on basic game mechanics on top of an existing experience that someone's having using automated systems. So there's a bunch of companies that do this where they say, oh, we're going to gamify your website, which really just means we're going to somehow add, you know, leaderboards, points, and whatever else to that experience. But typically it's not done super thoughtfully, where it's a sort of like saying, here is a house, you need to improve it, here's a hammer, go for it. So there's not really much, like the people that are actually doing these implementations, especially when there's no consulting going on, when it's literally just a company that provides the technological platform, then they don't know what they're doing. And games are really, game mechanics are really powerful tools to change behavior. But that means that if you don't know what you're doing, you can really sabotage yourself in a lot of ways. So when people do these implementations, they sometimes aren't aware of the kind of the psychological side of it. And that's not just goal setting. I mean, there's so many different theories that potentially, you know, explain different aspects of why games are successful, and you can borrow from any of those. But when you borrow from none of them, then that's when you end up having problems. It's usually points, badges, and leaderboards, but I've seen other contexts too, where people have tried to make, you know, actual like multiple choice type assessments more interesting by narrativization. Which really just means turning the assessment into a story. But they try to do that without any understanding of what makes stories interesting or you know, things that people would care to read. And so you end up with these bizarre things. Sometimes
they were written by a computer algorithm, right?
Yeah. And sometimes the context just makes no sense at all. Like there was in the beginning of gamification research, there was a lot of enthusiasm for just making things really gameful for no reason. And so you had people doing things like, oh, I'm going to turn my classroom into you know, a D&D campaign where we're going to have, instead of taking tests, you're slaying monsters. Instead of you know, instead of getting grades, you're getting new levels. And when you look at that, you're like, but is it really the fantasy that people like? Like, is that the motivating part of that? Is there some reason why fantasy would and creating a narrative surrounding fantasy about you slaying a monster, like why would that actually help the experience of you know, learning in a classroom or taking an assessment or whatever else? And there's not really any reason for it. It's just somebody saw, oh, you know, fantasy is very gamey, and so I'm going to do that gamey thing over here, and then I'm done. But that's not a good approach here. Yeah, it's in the piece that threatens most is, you know, it's not understanding the psychology of it. It's not understanding why people care and why people play games. And
yeah, it seems like that fantasy or the narrative element in the research that I've read, where that's applied to video games and other media, is like, that's something that attracts people to it. Like that, mm-hmm. that's a need that they want, and they decide to play a game or watch a show because it's the type of narrative or the type of fantasy. If you're at work or in a class, like, that's sort of a foregone conclusion, right? I mean, sure. you're already there, or you're required to be there for some other reason. I guess you could look at like situations where they get to choose between what job or what class they take, but yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, even in games, it's not enough. Like, I think if you do any game forum anywhere, there will be complaints. People really, really like the idea of a game. They're really excited about that kind of narrative context or the fantasy involved. But then when they actually play, the gameplay is just not there. And that's not... It becomes frustrating because you have the promise of an experience that you'll really enjoy, and then that promise is never fulfilled because the game mechanics are just not sufficiently sophisticated to support it. I mean, you look at something like No Man's Sky, which had so much media attention and so many people so excited, like, oh, infinite world and flying around the universe and you know, this colonization narrative and going around exploring and meeting aliens. I mean, it was so exciting, the things that you could do. But then once the mechanics came out, at least in the original version as released, people were angry because the actual experience, the psychological relationship that you have with the game, it didn't fulfill that promise.
Yeah, the way that those pieces fit together was not a pleasant picture.
And it was, you know, and honestly, that game was fine. I actually really enjoyed it right when it came out. But it didn't live up to the narrative promise. People had this idea in their head that they would, you know, be running around the galaxy and doing all this cool stuff. And in reality, it was, you know, fly around, kind of a zen little experience, and, you know, maybe go to another planet and see what that's like. And it was just not the same narrative that they had bought into. So when you use things like in gamification, when you use things like narrative to make a class more exciting, when you try to use fantasy elements and the points and levels and such, you're giving a promise that that's going to be an engaging experience and we're going to have fun here. And we're going to, you know, you have all these kind of ideas that people have in their head of like, this is what you're going to do. And then the reality of it is not that. It's still the same boring work it always was. And it's the same in the workplace context too. Like if you go in and gamify somebody's job by turning it into a big old narrative, well, it's still their job. Like the job hasn't changed unless you're engaging in work redesign or trying to, you know, actually make the work itself more interesting, then you're not going to create the kind of value you think you are. And that kind of change is expensive. I mean, you can gamify work that way. You can redesign, engage in job redesign, doing things like making the work more meaningful or giving more personal investment in the work, things that we would think of as like the job characteristics model. But if you don't do that thoughtfully, if you just do the window dressing, then people just get angry because, again, you're giving them a promise that you never fulfill.
Yeah, and they see it for what it is, you know, a half-assed attempt to do something about their problem. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about game-based assessments then. So besides gamification, we've seen a lot of companies and researchers that want to implement like those assessments, those tests, those measurement tools that look a lot like games. And in some cases, they look an awful lot like games. Like some of these things that I've seen, you could take them and put them on a mobile phone and then say, look at this game that I just downloaded. And I'd believe you, right? Because it looks like a game. It is a game. So can you kind of describe a few examples of what companies are doing along these lines?
Sure. And I think it's important to go back and again point out that there's both game-based assessments and gamified assessments. And we have been talking about gamified assessments a little bit, where, you know, you're taking an existing assessment and trying to make it gamey. When we talk about game-based assessments, those are usually built from the ground up as a way to assess some character trait of a person that you're interested in. We've worked with a few companies, some more than others. The one that we've done the most work with is a company in Australia called Revelion. They have a product called Cognify. And what Cognify is it's essentially a series of mini games. So you literally go in and you play like a kind of a color matching little mini game. And you play some picture rotation little mini games where you have a picture and you have to rotate some tiles to try to recreate it. You have some basic puzzle games where you're moving essentially marbles along a board and you get real-time scoring. I mean, as far as you could tell, it was basically like, you know, some of those classic like DS games, like Big Brain Academy, like those kind of games where you're just doing little puzzles that are all kind of different. It looks just like that. There is another side of the industry that is even more gamey, and there's a side that's less gamey. I shouldn't keep saying gamey. It's more gameful. the more gameful side, it starts to get into real kind of interactive, emergent kind of experiences. That's the side it's really undeveloped right now, but it's starting to grow. It stems from research that found you could learn a lot about people's kind of leadership potential from the way they played games like World of Warcraft.
Right.
And how you had, emergent kind of leadership characteristics. When you threw somebody in and there was a guild, you would see people literally emerge as leaders. They would start to engage in classic leadership behaviors and try to organize and try to get everybody moving in the same direction. And then you have all the way on the other side, that's a little more like gamification, where you have a more like a gamified assessment, where you have basic, you know, you'll open up and there'll be 10 slides and there'll be some maybe animation or picture going on and you have to choose which thing am I going to do. The line gets really fuzzy at some points because it's hard to tell whether it's an assessment that has been gamified or whether it was built as a game-based assessment. The ones that are obviously gamified are kind of terrible. You have my favorite example of this. I'm not going to name the company. Actually, I don't know if they exist anymore. But my favorite example of this was they had people go in and it was an endless runner in kind of your Temple Run or one of those style games. Yeah. And every so often you would get a multiple choice question and you had to choose to either go left or right or duck or jump to answer one of the four answers to the multiple choice question.
Okay.
Yeah. That's the correct reaction. It was not a great experience. And when you look at that, you're like, why bother with that? Why? What are you adding to the experience? And just like,
sounds like you're making it take an awful lot longer.
You are, yeah. But it comes from that same motivation you heard earlier, where you're saying, oh, if I make it gameful, people will like it, without really understanding what it is about games that people like. So you get a huge spectrum in what these things look like. And there's not really any single model for it right now. But you have all the way in those fully developed experiences, which are pretty uncommon, and that's really new. You have all the way down to the gamified stuff where it's just like a multiple choice test in a different format. And then these kind of middle ground companies who have been, you know, thoughtful about what games are and why people like them and tried to design an assessment around those principles.
So, and these would typically be used to assess somebody's abilities, like, you know, intelligence or mental abilities, or maybe even, like you said, like a situational judgment, like how would you react in this situation, or somebody's ability to perform a certain skill or task. That's usually like in an employment context, you would be saying like, okay, do we want to hire this person because do they have enough of this skill that we, you know, our research says is related to the job. But I guess it could be for all kinds of different contexts.
The key, I mean, it's this, the psychological concept of the construct, you know, some aspect of a human, some characteristic they have. And you can really, I mean, these things can target all sorts of different characteristics. So you have kind of knowledge and skill assessments. That was most studied in education, because there's a lot of people that do work in how can we trick, you know, like a sixth grader into taking assessments. So there's popularity, a concept called stealth assessment that people use there.
And I'm just picturing like Sam Fisher sneaking around and like teaching kids algebra.
Right. And it's funny. The most commonly researched game in that literature as a researcher named Valerie Shute. She does all of her work, or has been doing all of her work, on Plants vs. Zombies 2.
Okay.
So it's a weird kind of area, because you start to get into this concept I was talking about earlier, where do you take existing games and repurpose them versus do you actually create a brand new experience? And you can get useful information either way, but in the work context and the assessment for hiring context, it becomes I think a lot more important to have something that looks job relevant, that it appears to be related to what you're actually concerned about. So for knowledge and skill assessments, you really want to actually have people practice like a work-related skill in a game environment. It gets a little bit trickier when you get into ability assessment, like a cognitive ability intelligence type testing. And you also can do things like personality testing, which is probably the most difficult of all of those. Because trying to really understand, you know, kind of underlying pieces of information about somebody's personality and trying to distinguish that from, is it just how their personality plays out in this game versus not in this game? Or there's a lot more complexity that starts to kick in there.
Yeah. My PhD dissertation was actually about applicant reactions to assessments like that, with like an organizational justice framework. And, you know, one of the finding was that, if this doesn't look like the job, then they're less likely to trust it. They're more likely to complain or file, you know, a grievance with a union or a lawsuit or whatever. So it's tricky a lot of times. You can't just ask somebody to play Plants versus Zombies 2 necessarily and then expect them to react well with it. Maybe they'll have fun, but when you tell them they didn't get the job, they're not going to take it well.
Yeah, it's such a consistent finding already that people tend to view assessments as less fair when they don't win. So when you add in, now I have something to blame for not winning, then it gets real dicey.
But it sounds like it's hard to do this right, like you know, and expensive to develop something that really is a high quality game and that is at the same time a high quality assessment. And in a lot of ways, those two things are kind of opposing each other. So can you kind of talk about that? Like, why is this a complicated process and where do people typically go wrong that you've seen?
Sure. Well, I don't want to go too much in the weeds of measurement, but the basic idea behind any assessment design is that you're at least modern assessment design in the way that we typically measure constructs is that you're trying to get a bunch of different examples of someone engaging in a particular type of behavior. So say, for example, you're trying to assess somebody's, I don't know, how agreeable they are, like how much they like other people, then ideally you want to observe them in like, 20 different contexts and get a little bit of piece of information about how agreeable they are in each of those contexts so that you have kind of a consistent message about their behavior. Basically, all assessments are kind of designed around that idea. Whatever it is, if it's a skill, you want them to demonstrate the skill a bunch of times. If it's personality, you want them to do something that their personality trait should have caused them to do a bunch of times, and so on. So in games, it's still that same idea that you need to craft an experience where they are doing the same thing a bunch of times. And that's not really a great game design like foundation. Most games operate on this idea of iteration, that there's a core gameplay loop that people do different things every time. And you have to craft the experience such that each time you iterate over that loop and each time that you evolve the experience by introducing new mechanics or whatever else you might be doing, that you're still getting a nice clean example of whatever that trait is that you were trying to measure. And
I was going to say, a lot of modern games feature grinding where it does feel like you're doing the same thing over and over and over again. But when you look closely, they do have those little iterations you talk about where you're doing it in a slightly different area or using it with better gear that you just got cases where you're just literally, wandering through the high weeds to battle random Pokemon encounters over and over and over and over and over again are fairly few and far between and that you can't be sure that somebody would be into that.
Yeah, they're not broadly attractive. Like grinding was really interesting to me when I was like 9, because I had a lot of free time. And that's less interesting to me now. The kind of games, your classic JRPG design to these days has a very small audience, because modern game design has really evolved around this idea of interactive narrative, that you're experiencing an evolution of a story about who you are in the game. If you look at some, recently came out Red Dead Redemption 2, it's exactly that experience where the core of the game is you ride around a horse and you shoot at things, but they iterate on it to evolve it so that you feel like as a character, you're growing the more you play, you feel like you're gaining new skills, new capabilities, you're learning about the game world, the game environment, and the experience constantly feels fresh, even though you have that repeating piece. But in a measurement sense, that wouldn't be great, because for most traits, that means that you're tweaking and you're messing with the core core example of the behavior you're trying to measure. So if I was trying to use something like Red Dead Redemption 2 for measuring a personality trait, I would have to go in and say, well, in this situation, what are all the different reasons that the player could have done X? And then is in the second situation, what are all the different reasons the player could have done Y? And then try to figure out what all the commonalities are between them. And so when you have these hugely complex games that have lots of layers and lots of interesting, compelling components, you start to sacrifice and maybe do completely sacrifice a lot of the measurement characteristics, because it's just impossible to get a good, clean read on why anybody does anything.
Yeah, I've gotten questions from press and other people in the past, say, like, what can you tell us about the psychology of who you choose in Mario Kart? Like, what does that tell you about your personality? And my answer is like, you're not going to like the answer, but it's nothing.
Yeah.
You know, in isolation or in the way that you're describing, because there's just so many other factors at play.
Oh, yeah. Well, so then, yeah, it basically becomes, for the game designer, the person who's actually creating a game-based assessment, the goal becomes to try to strike that balance, to create a sufficiently simple experience that you know why people are doing the things they're doing, but simultaneously create a sufficiently complex and compelling experience that they actually want to play the game. And those two are a bit at odds, and there's better balance points than others, at least in the games I've seen. Not a lot of research on that, because there's, you know, only a few dozen commercial big assessment games right now. There's more all the time, but it's still a relatively small number at the moment. So there's just not a big range to look at to say, well, you know, this design works great and that design doesn't work great. But it does seem, at least from a casual review and from, you know, me paying attention to the industry for a few number of years now, that there are points where you do create a more compelling gameplay experience, and also have some interesting interactive components. And then other versions, like especially like that Temple Run type game I described, where you play it and you're like, why would anyone do this? Why play this game at all? Because part of what makes the Temple Run games, for example, fun is that it's a constant stream of challenges. It's just like challenge, 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 challenge. And in this, there's no challenge at all. You're just answering questions that have no right answer over and over again, which means at any given intersection, if you jump, if you turn left, if you turn right, whatever you do, it doesn't matter. There's no outcome. There's no stakes. There's none of the parts that make running games fun.
Yeah, you're not mastering any skill. You're not beating any score. You're not. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that makes it a very unsatisfying experience.
So you gave a talk recently, right? And I was actually in the audience for this one, and you kind of talked about this complexity question in a really interesting way by talking about what a lot of people probably think of as a pretty simple game, and that's Tetris. So, you know, you kind of gave the example of like talking about the mechanics and the dynamics and the aesthetics of Tetris, and how if you were trying to design an assessment sort of based on Tetris, there's a lot more going on sort of under the hood and in players' minds, where those various pieces, pardon the pun, I'm not talking about Tetraminos, but talking about those mechanics, dynamics, and aesthetics are all sort of fitting together in ways that non-game designers don't tend to think about. Can you kind of walk through that a little more to show why this stuff gets so complicated so quickly?
Sure. So it's, you know, people tend to think in has been called a gestalt, where you sort of evaluate the entire situation you're in as a whole holistically versus actually breaking down what you're experiencing into its component parts. So this happens in games. When we play Tetris, you tend to think of Tetris as a thing. You think of it as an experience. It's like it's a game and you play it and you're done. But Tetris, as you experience it, does not actually exist. There is no Tetris. What actually happened... What actually happens
is no Tetris.
Right. what actually happens is that a game developer creates all these systems that interact with each other to create what you experience as Tetris. Yeah. So they only create what are called mechanics. And so I've said the word mechanics a few times, but mechanic really just refers to any system built inside a game that, that does something. It's essentially waiting on inputs. It does something with the inputs it receives, and it outputs something out the other side. So in Tetris, there's a ton of mechanics. One is the piece falling system, right? So pieces mm-hmm. fall, and there's certain rules dictating how pieces fall and where they fall. You can't go beyond the left side of the board. You can't go beyond the right side of the board. You can't go up. You always fall, and there's a rate at which you fall. And when you fall down and you touch another tetromino, you're going to, the gameplay for that piece stops. Yeah. And then a new piece appears. But that interacts with a rotation system. Every time you push the button, the piece rotates. But most people don't think about how complicated that actually is, unless you're in competitive Tetris play, which does exist. When you push that button, that piece has to have a rule as to which part rotates and what it rotates on. And then when you have other pieces nearby, under what conditions can you rotate and how does it rotate interactively with those other pieces? So when you push that button, say you have your, in the simplest case, let's say you have your, four piece straight line. Does it rotate on the bottom square, the middle, one of the two middle squares, or the top square? And that's a rule someone had to define when they made Tetris. So that level of detail of decision making about how every individual system in the game is designed, somebody made a decision about that at some point. So you have the rotation, you have the different colors. Like, do colors mean things in Tetris? Sometimes they do and sometimes they don't, depending on the version of Tetris you're talking about. Do you have piece preview systems? Do you allow people to see what's coming up next? In terms of the next falling piece. Some Tetris games do, some Tetris games don't. So those are all these like interactive systems that people create. And you have levels and sounds, and the sound design is amazing by itself. Like, how do you determine when the music changes? That's a rule someone came up with. So all of those are mechanics. Dynamics then are how those mechanics interact with each other. So if you have, and with the player. So when you have that piece rotating system, and you also have the falling system, and you also have the piece stoppage system, meaning that when a piece gets to the bottom, it stops moving, and then it's sort of in place until something happens to it. Then suddenly that means you can create a situation where you have gaps and holes in the bottom of your map. And that's a core part of the Tetris experience. But nowhere did a programmer actually write in, oh, I'm going to make it so that players have a hard time filling complete lines, and I'm going to make it so that holes appear that they have to try to, clear out and try to get down to the bottom of. That's a dynamic that emerges as a result of the design choices made with the mechanics. Uh-huh. So a good example, a very easy example of this is what would happen if there was no multi-line scoring mechanic. So one of the mechanics for Tetris is if you, clear four lines at once, you get a quote unquote Tetris, and that's mm-hmm. worth a lot more points. It's harder. It's riskier. What would happen if you change that one mechanic, if you no longer got extra points for clearing multiple lines? And the answer is you would never clear multiple lines because you wouldn't care. You would always have the same rewards associated with clearing one line versus clearing two lines at once. So it wouldn't matter. And you fundamentally change the gameplay experience of Tetris by making that one tiny change in regards to the specific mechanics that have been implemented. Yeah. So that's mechanics and dynamics. Dynamics is how those mechanics interact together and with the player's behavior to emerge into some sort of interaction. The aesthetics then are the player's emotional connection with all of that. So part of the advantage of having those four line clears is that you create risk, which makes it a little more exciting. You know that you're taking that risk. You're like, I bet I can do it. I bet I can achieve this Tetris this time. I don't think there's too much for me. I think I can achieve it. I can get a higher score. You get excited about it. You feel satisfied when you're successful with it. Those are the aesthetics that emerge because of that dynamic. So that means that if you're targeting specific aesthetics in game development, including assessment games, your only control is over mechanics. You have to choose how to design the systems in your game to create the emotional experience that you actually want out the other end. Yeah. And it's why you see so much, user testing in gameplays. It's why you see focus groups, because it's very hard to predict exactly how people will experience the mechanics once you've implemented them. Game design is just enormously complicated because you can't actually predict that. Your only tool is essentially research, where you design mechanics that you think will work, and you're pretty sure these are the dynamics that you want, and pretty sure these are the aesthetics that you want, and then you send it to focus groups, you send it to play testers, and you have them give you feedback so that you can figure out, okay, I thought people would play it this way, but that's not what happened, and I need to change the mechanics to create new dynamics, to create new aesthetics so that people have a better experience. And because of the popularity of AAA games, the expectations now are just sky high that you will have a refined, just perfectly designed system where every aesthetic is just custom built to please the player. When you look at your AAA titles, Red Dead is one of those. If you look at like the Batman series, you look at any of these games that have come out recently where it's, you know, massive open world, everything's polished, everything's pretty, everything just looks amazing, everything's fluid. If you played the Batman games in particular, which I was just doing recently, so that's why it's on my mind.
Rocksteady ones, yeah.
The Arkham series Batman games.
Developed by Rocksteady, and somebody else did one of them. But yeah, absolutely. I love those, and they're very complex.
The fluidity of combat alone is astonishing. Yeah. The amount of time necessary to make that work, and the amount of game testing to say, oh, you know what? When people have the camera aimed just this direction, they actually want to target the next punch at this character, not this character. Like, that level of decision making in game design is now expected in terms of like the AAA experience. So another issue that we face with game-based assessment development is that when people that have a passing familiarity with games say they want a game-based assessment, they think they're getting a Red Dead or a Batman or one of these.
Okay. Have $200 million and a team of thousands. So yeah.
Right. Yeah. So it's enormously complicated, even for simple games, to get the mechanics right, to get exactly the dynamics you want. And as soon as you start adding complexity to that, it essentially becomes impossible to try to layer in the assessment components that you want simultaneously, because you're actively sabotaging some dynamics and possibly some aesthetics in order to get that consistency you need for measurement. So you have to balance it really carefully. And it's, there's not a lot of examples of it done really well.
And no matter how careful and deliberate you are, then, you know, unpredicted dynamics could come up based on those mechanics that you set, and players could then be motivated to do something that you were not expecting at all. And in fact, is counterproductive to your aim of getting a clean assessment.
Oh yeah. The open-ended piece is really difficult. My favorite emergent interaction in a video game was the frying pan in PUBG in PlayerUnknown Battlegrounds, where when you holster the frying pan, earlier in the version of the game, I actually don't know if they still do it, but you would tuck it into your belt behind you, and it would essentially, because the frying pan system was designed so that the frying pan blocked bullets, so you essentially ended up with, when your frying pan was holstered, you had a butt protecting frying pan. You couldn't be shot in the rear because you had this thing on there. And people discovered this, and it was not at all intended by the game designers, but they're like, oh yeah, well, let's keep that in, because that's a fun fun dynamic to emerge. So let's keep in this, you know, bullet blocking frying pan. So those kind of dynamics are great from a gameplay sense, because there's a sense of discovery and like, oh, look at this cool thing this game did. Yeah. But it's terrible from an assessment sense, because you lose control over the experience that you're trying to get reasonable numbers out of. So if somebody discovers a way to like, ooh, I can beat the game in a special way now, suddenly you've lost all the information about people beating the game in the way you are trying to measure. So if they find a way around the thing you're trying to measure, then suddenly you've lost all of your quality in terms of measurement.
Yeah. And like, my favorite application of that kind of thing is speed runs. So if you've ever watched like Games Done Quick or any speed run recordings on YouTube or wherever, you see people find these sort of emergent things a lot of times to do stuff like, you know, walk outside of the map, like you walk literally like across the top of the map to the end of the game in a few seconds. Or you may find them, you know, use certain mechanics to run faster or unlock an area where they shouldn't have been able to get into at that point in the game. That's like the sole reason that I love, more so than like just the skill on display, is like, what are the clever ways that they've busted this thing wide open?
Oh, yeah. It's watching even one of those, especially the ones that have no restrictions on how they beat the game.
Yeah.
You really start to see just how how fragile of a system most games are. Right. It's, you know, there's so many ways to take advantage of it. And in this context, in assessment, it's especially problematic because if there was ever, you know, if you discovered there was a game breaking bug in a game-based assessment, then suddenly that information could be shared quietly with, you know, people with enough money. And suddenly you have a community of people who are cheating on your test and you don't realize it because, you know, it's not like anybody sitting here reviewing a video of how somebody played a game. All you have is the data coming out the other end. So you think that they're, oh, wow, this is a really high performer. And reality, what happened is, oh, they learned that there's, you know, a wall glitch where they can jump through from level one to level two. And the game is just programmed in such a way that they automatically get a perfect score for doing that. Like right. That kind of stuff can emerge and you have no idea.
Yeah. Yeah. It turns out making games well is enormously complicated process. But so do you want to talk about the one study that you did where you did help like validate one of these game-based assessments?
Yeah. Well, that's the Cognify platform that I mentioned in the beginning. It's a cognitive assessment, which is really just meaning that it's looking at, you know, how efficiently and how effectively people can think through problems, right?
Intelligence, basically, for most people listening to this, yeah.
More or less, yeah.
More or less. I know. Yeah. We psychologists quibble about. But yeah, it's measuring how much ability you have to think and learn and remember and so forth. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So the key in intelligence research or cognitive ability research is that cognitive ability is kind of multidimensional, where people will have things like a visual spatial reasoning, which is really your ability to, you know, look at a complex 3D shape or 2D shape and understand it. So say, for example, I gave you say I took like five Tetris pieces and I put them in 3D and then I locked them together into a little shape. And I asked you, what would this look like if I flipped it 90 degrees to the left? Mm-hmm. That's a visual spatial reasoning task to see, like, can you reason through how the look of it changes in space? You also have basic like mathematical reasoning, like which of these numbers is bigger or which of these calculations results in a bigger number. Think of like your GRE and SAT type questions. And there's a lot of different dimensions to it. So what they did in this assessment game is they actually looked at that research and said, well, how can we design mini games to kind of target all these different aspects of cognitive ability, these different ways to conceptualize intelligence? And they built mini games around each one of them. And they're relatively simple from a game design standpoint in the sense that, you know, there's one core game goal in each mini game, and it kind of iterates in terms of difficulty, but the core experience is the same. But in doing so, they create a really nice, solid measurement of those experiences. So if you take, for example, a visual spatial reasoning task or a mini game in this case, then they basically just give you, and I think I mentioned it before, they give you these tiles and they ask you, they give you a picture of an object and they say, okay, use these tiles to create this picture, but rotate it 180 degrees. And so you have to think through how to do that. And the game starts out really easy and it gets more difficult as you play, which is also in line with good measurement as well, because you want a good range of difficulties so to get a good sense of where people actually fall. And so they were really successful with it. They ended up actually corresponding great to a traditional cognitive ability test battery. We had, for the technically inclined, a latent correlation about 0.97.
That's good.
Yeah, basically identical. It's essentially the core that caused people to be successful across the mini games is cognitive ability. And that's for an assessment person, that's a strong statement, but I'm confident in that conclusion. That's really great. I mean, I think it really serves as a compelling test case that this can be done well. That you can set out to design an assessment that doesn't sacrifice measurement principles, but also creates a pretty compelling experience. Because one of the other things that we did in that study is we compared how people reacted to that system.
I was going to ask, like, why? Why? If just doing a paper or on-screen version is easier and cheaper, why? What'd you find?
People liked it better. The traditional cognitive ability test batteries, your kind of intelligence test, people just don't care for in general.
No figure.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it is that they're designed to be hard. So it's that same sort of fairness thing earlier that when people do badly on a test, they tend to say, oh, that wasn't a fair test. It's the same basic idea here, where if you have a hard cognitive ability test, people struggle through it. They're like, I don't like this. I don't want to do this anymore. So the game actually does mitigate that a little bit, where people have a more positive experience with the cognitive ability game than they will with the cognitive ability tests. That's part of it. There's a second piece, which is that it's faster, that when you, to get the same amount of information about cognitive ability in tests, you're going to have someone sit down in either a paper and pencil test or a web-based test or some kind of assessment where they're literally going question to question, and giving multiple choice or written answers. And it takes longer. It's more time consuming. So there's a kind of a practical piece to it, in terms of, system design. And then you also have the promise for the future of these games, which is that unlike a traditional cognitive ability test battery, we have all this metadata, what you would call trace data, about how people actually behaved in these games. Mm. You have clicks and you have mouse movements, and you have how long do they pause before clicking on the next button? How much, you know, basically it's an incredible level of detail and data collection, in terms of, you know, their experience with this game. And the promise for the future is that those data can be used to inform further measurement, that we can either refine our measurement of cognitive ability even better, or possibly get measure of other constructs based on people's behaviors as they play the game. So, you know, you can imagine, for example, what happens if a person is kind of nervous. Can you actually assess nervousness going through an assessment based on tentative clicks or double clicks, or, you know, how people are actually experiencing this thing? And I don't know if you would use that for selection or not, but it's an interesting piece of context to have, so that you know, oh, this person was really nervous when they took this game-based assessment, and you could theoretically make additional decisions based on that. Like, maybe we should bring them in for an extra interview and get clarity on some of these things. Maybe their game performance isn't quite as strong as it should have been because they were nervous. I mean, there's any number of possibilities for the future as to
maybe
what to
do with that. Really like nervous people, so let's hire them on the spot.
Yeah, right. But it's this additional opportunity for data collection without extra effort, which is a major direction right now for the assessment industry in general. This idea that maybe you know, there's a bunch of companies that have popped up where you join this recruitment firm and you take their tests one time, and then they shop your tests around to a bunch of different firms as a way to kind of encourage people to apply for more jobs but with less effort. So games are definitely a part of that movement. And plus, for those companies, games can be very attractive, because you can say, come and play, you know, a little suite of games with us and we'll get you a job. And that's a really compelling kind of market proposition that traditional assessment firms don't really have. Where they'll say, we'll get you a job, but you're going to kind of be miserable while you take these tests. It's really the message. So here you can say, it'll be easy. It'll be fun. Don't even worry about it. And you'll get a job. So that's it's a compelling message, I think.
You know, the stuff you're talking about with the trace data and, you know, the extra data, we're looking at, like, how long do people hover over things and so forth. You know, I've seen articles recently about firms that say things like, our AI can look at your Facebook use or look at your social media use, and then we can measure your intelligence and your Big Five personality and all this other informational. And I kind of look at that and I'm like, all right, there's problems with that on multiple levels, the least of which is, or the greatest of which is whether or not it's actually true. So you're making sounds that make it seem like you're skeptical.
So it's kind of true. So you definitely can get information out of people by harvesting random pieces of information about them from all sorts of different places.
Yeah.
The problem is that it's a very uncontrolled environment. So whereas I could get a lot of good information about, like on Facebook, I could get a lot of really good information about a person who is a power Facebook user because they have a lot of data, a person that's not a power Facebook user, not so much, because there's just, even if they use it, but they only use it casually and in certain contexts, now you've changed the kind of information you have. It still goes back to this idea of behavioral consistency and measurement. You want to have multiple examples of a behavior kind of emerging because of a trait somebody has. But just like in video games, people use Facebook for a lot of different reasons and in a lot of different ways. So most of that research is done on the high users, the people that have a lot of examples of, like, some of the early research was or one of the big ones that got a lot of press was based on kind of predecessor to the Cambridge Analytica data set, which was done Mikhail Kaczynski at Stanford, and did this study where you could find
a flow guy, right? Oh no, I'm sorry. You said, I thought you said Csikszentmihalyi, but
oh no, 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 Kaczynski. Yeah, so yeah, he was, yeah, yeah. No, Kaczynski was. If you read the Cambridge Analytica stuff, there were two researchers, and one of them said, "Well, we'll sell them the technology, but not the data." And the other one says, "Ah, we'll just do whatever." The one that said we'll sell the technology, but not the data, is Mikhail. So that's the ethical one in the pair. So the. His research, which was based on that original Cambridge data set, was determining how many likes can you use to get a Big Five profile out of somebody. And the answer was in the paper that you could get as few as like 7 or 8 likes and get a Big Five profile out of it. Huh. But what was kind of not mentioned in that is that they only looked at people who had a huge amount of likes. So it's not like you're actually finding people who have 8 likes. It's you're finding people who have thousands of likes and you're taking a random sample of 8 of them, which is a different question. So as soon as you move into this area of trying to get examples of, you know, consistent examples of behavior and things like Facebook, it's my view right now is that it can provide some extra context and maybe improve measurement on existing measures that are pretty good. That's why I like it in the games context, because I wouldn't replace the thoughtful measurement part that I've talked about in for like Cognify. I wouldn't replace that with trace data, but trace data may provide some extra context that could be useful for it. So, like, and the other piece of
generation or
And the other piece about games too is it's still a self-contained experience. So I designed this game to have certain trace data, whereas on Facebook, you're just harvesting whatever random info that you happen to have access to.
Right.
So that's a very, very different situation in terms of the consistency.
All right. I feel like we could keep talking about this for hours and hours, but you know, we've kind of been going for a while. So to kind of wrap things up, are there any papers or talks or anything else that people should be on the look out for? Got anything coming up?
Well, I mean, we're about to put out the paper that I've been talking about. Validating Cognify. That's going out into review in the next week or two. Hopefully sooner, but you know, academic writing. So, the things that we're really excited about now, you know, a lot of our research is about trying to understand in what context do we get new and useful information that we couldn't get otherwise. Games offer some possibility for that. There's also, different media for games, and we've been looking recently at virtual reality as a context in which to get new information about people. It's like right now, one of the very hard things to measure in a person is anything having to do essentially with emotion. If you want to ask a question like, well, how well do they adapt to stress? How well do they interact with other people when there's expectations placed on them? How do they mitigate complex emotional situations between other people? Right now, all of our measurement techniques revolve around things like situational judgment, where you describe to someone a situation, say, what would you do here? But we don't have that real-time performance component because unless you do something like a role play, and that is done in some places, but it's very expensive. Yeah. So VR potentially offers a situation where you can essentially create an interactive experience in VR that unfolds and requires people to engage with it in some way. And you can have a very gameful experience that way, where you go in and, you know, there's essentially a narrative about a business that you want to apply to, or there's a narrative about, you know, you're a manager and a situation is unfolding and you need to interact. And the VR provides an immediacy, an emotional immersion that you don't get in other media. Yeah. So
being more cost effective in a lot of ways.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the classic way to do this with role plays is assessment centers, and assessment centers involve flying people out to a central location and giving them room and board for a day or two. And I mean, I've seen estimates everywhere from $1,000 to $10,000 per candidate to bring people out. Yep. And at that level, it becomes a lot cheaper to just mail an Oculus to somebody and just say, here, put this on at whatever time you want, and it's going to collect some data and then just mail it back to us. So there's situations when you really want that deep assessment, that really complex assessment, but you want to reduce your costs, where something like a VR-based game-based assessment approach would be the right option. But really understanding when that occurs and when that would be, because it's not going to be a good idea to do that if you just want to measure personality. Like, we can already do that with what we have. Yeah. But there are going to be constructs that are more interesting and contexts that are harder to capture that 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 kind of environment might be, you know, a better choice. And so we're really trying to understand where and when that is.
That's awesome. Yeah, I look forward to hearing about what you find out there and the research to come out of that.
Yeah.
So have you been playing any games lately? You had time to do that?
Yeah, you know, I feel like an important part of being a games researcher is that you have to keep playing games.
Yeah,
it's your
burden to bear. Yeah,
right. I do a combination of mobile and PS4 and Steam. I think I can get in half an hour every day, sometimes a little more. Right now is all Red Dead. And that's going to be a 100-something hour experience. So this is going to take me like a couple months.
So probably. I take it you're liking it then.
Yes, yes, I am enjoying it quite a bit. It's very impressive in a technical way, in the same sort of way that when GTA 5 came out, that was the same experience I had then. It was just like, wow, this is a real world, a real functioning environment. Mm-hmm. And in this, all the way down to, you know, I had a bad experience in the game in that I didn't realize I had autosave turned off. I lost like 6 hours of gameplay. But I played through a second time from that point back to where I was. And so many things were slightly different. And when I did things more efficiently or better, it actually changed the game in ways that I would not even have realized if I hadn't played through it twice. And it really gave me a better sense of the scope of, again, the gameplay mechanics. Little things, I mean, tiny things, like when you're riding along with another character, an NPC, if your horse is too far away from that character, you'll start to raise your voice, meaning that they actually recorded two different versions of all horse-based dialogue, which is incredible. I mean,
and then blended the two sort of circumstances. Yeah.
Yeah, it's an unbelievable level of attention to detail, and it just really makes me appreciate the depth to which they thought through and playtested this. Because you can imagine that coming emerging in playtesting, somebody's playing it, and I'm like 300 feet away from that guy, and I'm talking in conversation levels, and that seems weird.
Yeah.
And then to somebody say, "Oh yeah, we should definitely change the volume of the recordings
spend $20 million fixing that little
problem." Right. Right.
Yeah.
Right. And to actually go to that effort to do that and to really have such a pride and budget that becomes a useful, valuable piece of game design.
Yeah.
But it's also those kind of things that make people think that game-based assessments are going to be like that. And they are not like that. they are more, Plants vs. Zombies level, fun experiences. They look nice and they have good gameplay, but you're not going to get that level of complexity.
Yeah. I agree with everything you said about Red Dead 2. Technically it's amazing, and artistically it's amazing. The voice acting, the story and all that is great. And it's an open world where you can do just all kinds of things. But I kind of bounced off of it. I may not be done with it, but I'm not as hot on it as some other people do. It's like every part of it where you're actually playing a game just doesn't seem very well done to me. So like, the gunplay and the shooting, which you spend a lot of time doing, especially in the story missions, it's tough. There's no meaning. There's no good fast travel system to get around this huge world. There's no, like, the crafting sort of seems pointless, and you can only have like one large thing on your horse at a time. So it seems like they've made all of these decisions for the sake of realism, but not for the sake of like fun or gameplay. So, and the bugginess of like, crashes has happened a couple of times. And
I haven't had any crashes.
Yeah. I think it's actually kind of rare. I probably shouldn't say or give the idea that it's particularly buggy, but it does happen to people. But when you have as many people playing one game as this one has, you're going to get some, low probability things happening.
They did make a lot of artistic decisions, I guess I would say, to increase the realism. The lack of fast travel is a little astonishing to me. However, that's a little mitigated by the fact that I'm playing it on a 4K OLED TV. When I go into cinematic mode during the giant, like, 5-minute long horse rides, it's just like, oh, this is so pretty.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit better that way. And they have a couple factors.
Playing on like a regular HD TV without HDR, like a peasant. But
it's worth it. I waited for Black Friday to get this and to get the TV, for specifically for this game, because I knew it was such a you know, they put so much effort into the environment. Yeah. And it really pays off. Let me tell you, it's an amazingly gorgeous game in full resolution.
Yeah.
Maybe I may have some starry eyes just because it's so pretty, but
that's fine. Enjoy your starstruck experience. It's all yours. Nobody can take that away from you. Right. So where on the internet can people go to find out more about you and your research? Where would you point them?
Oh, sure. So most of my, my academic record, if you're looking for like research papers and just a description of what my lab does, is on rlanders.net. But I also write a more public facing blog, which is neoacademic.com, neoacademic.com, which is really about, I try to focus on the kind of intersection between IO psychology, mostly from the perspective of employee hiring and employee training, and technology in general. Games are a big part of it. We also do, some machine learning and artificial intelligence research, and we get into this VR space too. So
cool.
So yeah.
So it sounds like if anybody was into what we talked about here on this episode, that they would find something of interest there as well.
Yeah, I hope so.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. This is definitely hits on sort of the intersection of my greatest interests of psychology, games, and IO psychology, psychology applied to the workplace and how technology is shaping that. So this stuff is all fascinating and really seems like you and the people you're working with are on the forefront of some stuff that needs somebody at the forefront and studying this stuff. 'Cause it's going to happen either way.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. We're trying, I think academia has a tendency to sit back and observe, but I like the academic model of engineering. They invent stuff. So I'm trying to invent some things here. I'm optimistic. I think it'll work out.
Awesome. Well, thanks again.
Thanks again for listening to the Psychology Games podcast. Remember to go to psychologyofgames.com to find out how to support me on Patreon, how to follow me on Twitter or Facebook, and to scoop up all the articles and past podcasts that you can stand. I'll see you there.